6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. A U.S. defense spokesman Tuesday said a U.S. drone strike last week killed al-Qaeda leader Abu Afghan al-Masri in northwestern Syria.
Al-Masri, an Egyptian, originally joined al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and later moved to its Syrian affiliate. He had ties to terrorist groups operating throughout Southwest Asia, including groups responsible for attacking U.S. and coalition forces in Afghanistan and those plotting to attack the West.
Peter Cook said al-Masri's removal from the battlefield November 18 is another blow to al-Qaeda in Syria. Meanwhile, U.S. spokesman John Kirby says Secretary of State John Kerry spoke Tuesday by phone with his Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, about Syria.
The Secretary and the Foreign Minister talked about the importance of continuing to work towards a cessation of hostilities in trying to find ways to get that cessation of hostilities in a place where it can lead to a resumption of political talks and to try to build a framework that can make sense for that cessation of hostilities to actually work.
Meanwhile, monitors in and near the embattled city Aleppo report Russian-backed Syrian forces are pushing deeper into opposition-occupied neighborhoods. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said they pounded the area with airstrikes and barrel bombs as ground troops advanced in the key eastern district of Masakin Hanano. A report quoting a military source said at least 6 Cameroonian soldiers were killed Monday in an attack by Boko Haram militants on a Lake Chad army base manned by a regional anti-insurgent force. Meanwhile, UN official Toby Lanzer warned that up to 1 million people around Lake Chad are cut off from humanitarian aid by Boko Haram. And jihadist fighters are said to be overrunning villages near the northeastern Nigerian town of Chibok, forcing hundreds of residents to flee. Local officials describe the town as under siege. This is VOA News. In an interview with the New York Times published Tuesday, President-elect Donald Trump said he would keep an open mind about pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement on climate change. But he said he's considering its impact on American business. Mr. Trump also appeared to soften his campaign rhetoric in prosecuting his Democratic rival, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, over her handling of classified information on a private computer. Mr. Trump is quoted as saying he doesn't want to hurt the Clintons. Former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, a close aide to Mr. Trump, said he's not surprised.
Look, there's a tradition in American politics that after you win an election, you sort of put things behind you. And if that's the decision he reached, that's perfectly consistent with sort of a historical pattern of things come up, you say a lot of things, even some bad things might happen, and then you can sort of put it behind you in order to unite the nation.
However, Mr. Trump said he may continue to investigate the Clintons' charitable foundation for possible wrongdoing. And Mr. Trump has reportedly offered former Republican rival Dr. Ben Carson the post of Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. The Obama administration has approved a second license to the European Aviation Consortium Airbus for the sale of dozens of commercial aircraft to Iran. It's part of the international nuclear deal reached with Tehran that eased international sanctions. The decision came as Republican lawmakers urged President Obama to refrain from boosting international investment in Iran before Mr. Trump takes office. White House spokesman Josh Earnest said the Airbus decision was a long time in coming.
The kinds of actions that we have taken in implementing the deal are the kinds of actions that have had to go through a rather extended process. So I can confirm for you that I do not anticipate any actions being taken that were initiated after the election solely in response to Mr. Trump's victory.
Mr. Trump has long been critical of the Iran nuclear agreement. U.S. approval of the Airbus deal required since some parts were made in the U.S. A revised peace agreement between the Colombian government and rebels of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, is to be signed Thursday and sent to Congress for approval. President Emeritus and Senior Fellow Peter Huckam of the Washington-based Inter-American Dialogue said the deal is not universally supported.
But it will almost surely get the support of Congress, and it will go into effect, and they will begin to implement it.
The agreement, rejected by the Colombian people in a referendum last month, aims to bring the hemisphere's longest-running civil war to an end. The International Committee of the Red Cross says civilians in the embattled Yemeni city Taiz are trapped by sniper fire and indiscriminate shelling. It described dead bodies lying in the streets, hundreds wounded in the past 3 days. The fighting followed Monday's collapse of a 48-hour truce. Despite opposition, South Korea signed an intelligence-sharing agreement with Japan over North Korea. I'm Victor Beatty reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Botte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations prepares for crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
If these things happen, we have a contingency plan, which is built around what we have called the hotspots, places where we anticipate that political strife will happen because they are opposition strongholds or there is a history of political conflict in these places.
Mamadou Diallo is the humanitarian resident coordinator of the UN mission in the DRC. Doctors are working hard to contain future Ebola outbreaks, and presidential and legislative term limits in Liberia have been recommended for a constitutional referendum, but not without opposition.
It's not that I am not in favor. It's the constitution that we must abide by. Other than that, it would be without meaning to say that you run your state because people want things to happen and it happened like that.
Bofal Chambers is a member of the House of Representatives of Liberia. Also in Liberia, a watered-down affirmative action bill has been recommended for a constitutional referendum. Health officials say the Zika virus is here to stay and must be managed. A Tanzanian tribe turns to carbon offsets to protect ancestral forests, and two female artists blaze the trail in African pop music. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations is making contingency plans to respond to a sudden increase in humanitarian needs should the Democratic Republic of Congo's political situation turn violent. From the United Nations viewers, Margaret Bashir has more.
The UN has been warning for several months that without a serious national political dialogue, tensions in the DRC could deteriorate into a severe and possibly violent crisis. The UN has some 20,000 peacekeepers in the country's volatile east and has been conducting military contingency planning to protect civilians if the situation escalates. On Tuesday, the mission's humanitarian and resident coordinator, Mamadou Diallo, told a small group of member states that his team is also preparing should there be election-related violence or mass displacement.
If these things happen, we have a contingency plan, which is built around what we have called the hotspots. Places where we anticipate that political strife will happen because they are opposition strongholds or there is a history of political conflict in these places.
The DRC has been a focus of humanitarian efforts for the past two decades due to internal conflicts and natural disasters, and as recipient of refugees from its neighbors. Currently, Diallo said the country is coping with yellow fever and cholera epidemics and is close to eradicating a measles outbreak. The UN appealed for nearly $700 million for humanitarian needs in DRC this year, but has just received over half the amount, enabling it to assist almost 6 million people. Diallo said they expect nearly 8 million Congolese to need aid next year. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
A committee of the Liberian House of Representatives last week approved a recommendation to reduce the terms of office for president, vice president, and members of the House of Representatives from 6 to 5 years to 4 years. The lawmakers also agreed to reduce the terms of office of senators from 9 to 6 years. Currently, the president, vice president, and members of the House of Representatives serve 6-year terms, while senators serve 9 years in their first terms. A constitutional convention held in early 2015 overwhelmingly approved reducing the terms of office of the president, vice president, and members of the legislature. Representative Bofal Chambers is one of the lawmakers who was against the proposal. He says the process did not follow constitutional guidelines.
Basically, as it has been put that the House has endorsed, it's not the fact, though statements emanating from the House led in that direction. But as far as it is, the requirements were not met. One of those requirements, which is cardinal, is only Article 91. It states that for the Constitution to be amended, 2/3 of the membership of both houses, and in our House, the House of Representatives, we needed 49 persons to pass on that. And before that even could have happened, we should have had signatures coming from the public, not fewer than 10,000. Even we did not get signature of up to 1,000. And then when we deliberated in the House, it was only 18 persons that voted in favor. So basically, there is no way that these things can go for any kind of a referendum. Even to legitimately pass our house or constitutionally pass our house to go to the House of Senate.
Representative, one of the rules you are talking about, you mentioned the submission of signatures. My understanding is that before the Constitutional Review Commission came up with this recommendation, there was a conference of Liberians all around who met in, I think, Bangui. So doesn't that amount to or equate to the kind of signatures you're looking for?
Yeah, it should have been to be submitted to us. But the assembly in Bangui did not even come up to 2,000 persons. And we are talking about not fewer than 10,000, meaning that 10,000 or above. So everything that happened was wrong for the president to even have, forwarded that to us without the signature. It was also wrong.
A member like you and those who spoke also like you during the debate, you know, are not in favor of the recommendation of the Constitutional Review Commission to reduce the term of office of a member of representative, House of Representatives, from 6 to 4. And would you give me your reasons for that, if that is your view?
Well, let me, for the sake of our discussion, for me, I like, because democracy is a rules-based, system. And we in Liberia, also, we're supposed to be following our rules within the scope of the principles of democracy. It's not that I am not in favor. I mean, it's the Constitution that we must abide by. Other than that, it will be without meaning to say that you're running your state because people want things to happen and it happened like that.
Bofal Chambers is a member of the Liberian House of Representatives. He is speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Earlier this year, the Liberian Senate approved an affirmative action bill that set aside 15 legislative seats for females. Later, the House of Representatives reduced the 15 to 5. A Constitutional Review Commission last year recommended equal representation for women. Now, a committee of the House of Representatives has recommended to put that issue to a national referendum to be held sometime in 2018, but first it must be ratified by both the Senate and the House. Fubi Ama Henrys is a Liberian whose citizens group, Friends of Fubi, lobbied the lawmakers to send the bill to a national referendum. He says it is unconstitutional for 103 lawmakers to enact a law creating equal representation for women.
Firstly, the upper house proceeded wrongly, violating the constitution by approving a bill for 21 exclusive seats for people with disability, youth, and women. And the lower house also joined them but reduced the number of seats from 21 to 7 and creating an additional 5 extra constituencies that are not backed by the constitution of Liberia. So we challenged their actions and said that they don't have the mandate to pass such a bill, because it borders on the constitutionality of the state. And if the bill has to go in, it has to be done through a national referendum, as stated in our Constitution Article 91. Anything that borders on the Constitution must be amended by 2/3 majority of the House or 10,000 signatures from the citizens, which should be also concurred by 2/3 members of the House and should be forwarded for a national referendum and be voted upon by 2/3 of the voting population in a national referendum conducted by the election commissions.
What do you say to women like, say, Senator Jewel Howard Taylor, one of the sponsors of the affirmative action bill, that women are underrepresented in almost every sector of the Liberian society compared to other countries, despite the fact that Liberia has had a female president for almost 11 years now? What do you say to her?
So firstly, I say we have adopted a process which is democratic, and democracy calls for the will of the people. And female candidates go in a race and they are not voted for. It is not something that we should blame on the people and force it on us. It's like the people decide who they want as their leader. So if you put up a female candidate and if she doesn't meet or appeal to the minds of the voters, they definitely will not vote her in. So it is not about sympathy. Our constitution is clear. and there's nothing sympathetic about it, and it doesn't discriminate against people or sex, gender, or your condition. So we are saying affirmative action should be diverted to the private sector, to the businesses. There are a lot of concessions that we sign, and those concessions, we should make sure that we use affirmative action in encouraging the employers to employ more females and improve their capacity. We're also saying there are also schools, a special field that females don't usually venture into. So we're saying government should also raise funding to pump into those sectors to encourage females to go and take up some of those courses and improve themselves and bring themselves up to par.
Do you agree, Mr. Henry, that the Liberian society, as is right now, has little room for women to advance in life, say, for example, in education and other areas?
No, we don't have little room. We're saying government, it should be an executive action where there's funding available, encourage the females and say, for example, if we want to put more women into the engineering field, which they don't, most of the time they shy away, probably because of resources, we say government can allot funding, subsidy, and pump into the school system. And every female that would take advantage of this course, you stand a chance of benefiting from probably 50% or 75% reduction in your fee. So you will see more women taking advantage of those fields and improving their lives. And once they are graduated, government should also create opportunities for them to find jobs and make some extra money. That way, women will rise up to the task faster than having one or two persons sitting in a house that might not be seeking the interest of the vast majority.
I'm asking these questions because here in the United States, there's something called affirmative action. Whether at university level, societal level, for a certain segment of society that has been for some reason underrepresented or that have had laws stacked against that particular group. Particularly in the case of Liberia, you would think that an affirmative action is a good thing.
Yes, I agree with you. Like you said, it should be directed to those sectors like the university where you encourage more females to learn and improve their skills, as opposed to restricting it to elected positions, because elected positions, as per our constitution, it is clear. There is no segregation, there is no discrimination in the law. So you cannot come and segregate and come up with discriminatory laws against the constitution.
Fubi Ama Henrys is a Liberian. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Today's Wednesday, November 23rd, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout out to listeners on this, our VOA affiliate station, Radio Life in Lofa County, Liberia, Radio Banga, FM 96.5 in Bong County, Central Liberia, Buffalo FM also in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, and Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi. Daybreak Africa time is 18 and a half minutes past the hour. More than 10,000 people died during the Ebola epidemic in West Africa. VOA's Maria Mandialo looks into what's being done by health agencies to prevent the deadly virus from getting out of control again.
Now he's disinfecting the body.
The 2014 Ebola outbreak in West Africa was the deadliest in history, and healthcare specialists are working to prevent the next one.
Countries might officially be declared Ebola-free, but challenges remain. And for those reasons, the work of agencies like the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention continues.
The CDC's Dr. Barb Marston.
The virus can hang around in the body of people who have survived Ebola and can then be spread to other people and start new outbreaks. In fact, there have been 7 clusters of Ebola since the epidemic was controlled, 3 in Liberia, 3 in Sierra Leone, and 1 that started in Guinea.
Countries are better prepared now, says CDC's Liberia country director, Dr. Desmond Williams.
In March, we had a case again in a remote part in Guinea, and a case, one of the contacts from that particular family moved down to the capital city of Liberia, Monrovia. But because the two governments were ready this time, we were able to limit that outbreak to 13 infected people and 9 people dead.
Our biggest focus in all 3 countries is on activities related to surveillance, and laboratory and building human capacity. Right now we have a team of about between 50 and 60. That's counting people who are Americans that are permanently stationed in the three countries, mm-hmm. plus some locally employed staff and also some from staff from the offices here at CDC that are traveling there temporarily to assist.
Although the epidemic is over, hospitals in the U.S. are not letting down their guard. Dr. Colleen Kraft is with Emory University Hospital in Atlanta, which treated four U.S. Ebola patients. She says today her work is all Ebola related.
Nebraska, Emory, and Bellevue all are in one group called NETEC, which is the National Ebola Training and Education Center. And essentially, we are tasked with training, educating, and exercising and visiting every hospital in the United States that is preparing to take care of a patient with Ebola virus.
Affected countries and organizations around the world dedicated unprecedented resources to combat the Ebola epidemic. With preparation, surveillance, and community cooperation, they hope that when the next Ebola outbreak comes, they can contain and reduce the disease's toll. Mariama Diallo for VOA News, Atlanta.
Although public health officials and researchers have made some progress in understanding and controlling the Zika virus, the World Health Organization says Zika is here to stay and must be managed as a long-term problem. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Little was known about the Zika virus when the WHO declared the disease an international public health emergency in February. Since then, the UN agency has learned that the virus will continue to spread and that it causes microcephaly, a brain abnormality in newborn babies. But WHO Executive Director of Health Emergencies Program, Peter Salama, says a great deal about the virus remains unknown and needs to be investigated, so he says the current emergency program will be transformed into a medium and long-term program of work that will address many of the outstanding issues.
WHO will continue to work with countries so they're best prepared to deal with this acute public health priority with new tools, with better data, and with the best scientific advice possible to inform their response as we all collectively learn more about this public health threat.
Anthony Costello is WHO Director of Maternal, Newborn, Child, and Adolescent Health. He says Zika may no longer be a public health emergency in official terms, but it is still a public health problem of huge concern for the world.
69 countries have seen Zika virus emerge in the last 2 years. We're talking about a virus that causes brain damage and potentially lifelong disability, which is a huge blow to families. We know in Brazil, where the problem was first picked up, that there are now 2,100 confirmed cases, but there are many others still being investigated, and on current trends, we expect another 1,000 cases to be picked up.
The World Health Organization has appealed for $112 million to implement its Zika program through next year. So far, it has received $50 million. WHO says it is scaling up its work to help countries fight the virus. It says it will help them set up surveillance systems so they can better track and detect the virus, and it will work with countries to develop and strengthen their national response plans. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Experts estimated that the Hadzabe people have lived in the same area of northern Tanzania for more than 40,000 years. They are one of the world's last hunter-gatherer tribes, and they are fighting for survival. Since the 1960s, they have lost 90% of their land. But now, the Hadzabe have turned to a decidedly modern invention, the global carbon trading market, to help them preserve the forests that they call home. Willie Lowry has the story from Yeda Valley.
The Hadzabe still use the same kind of wooden bows and arrows their ancestors used. They live off the animals they hunt and what they forage from the forest.
Fruits like midabi, berries and toothbrush trees. That is a traditional of Hadzabe. Meat, roots and baobabs.
But it's becoming harder.
The environment is destroyed. It's not the same as we used to live before in those days. When we used to live with our parents, there used to be a lot of animals around. My old man used to roam for just a little while in the forest and come back with a big antelope.
Rival tribes have moved into the area, transforming the forests of the Yaita Valley into agricultural and grazing land. But now a local social enterprise is trying to help. Carbon Tanzania sells what are known as carbon offsets to local and international companies looking to reduce their carbon footprint. Scientists say an excess of greenhouse gases, like carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere due to the burning of fossil fuels is contributing to global warming. Trees naturally absorb carbon dioxide, thus mitigating the impact. The sale of carbon offsets pays Hadzabi forest rangers. Other proceeds are funneled back into the community.
What we're saying to companies and individuals is, take the step to reduce your impact on the natural world by supporting the conservation of this natural habitat, which also supports the lifestyle, in this case, of a very special indigenous cultural group.
To date, the community has received roughly $150,000, which they spend on healthcare, education, and other community projects.
Carbon Tanzania told us to conserve and protect the forests so no one cut down trees. There are benefits from carbon. We get t-shirts and money, which we use to buy some basic necessities.
Filippo hopes the Hadzabi will be able to continue their traditions for generations to come. Willie Lowry for VOA News in the Yaita Valley, Tanzania.
Modern West African pop music features few female voices, and you won't find many women on the DJ scene across the continent. But two women from opposite sides of Africa have been busy changing the picture. Brian Postamont met them both at the recent World Music Expo in Spain.
For 20 years, this woman has been a fixture on the club scene in her own country.
Yeah, hi. DJ Rachel from Uganda. Kampala, East Africa, Africa.
She is Uganda's first female DJ, and for many years, she was the only one. She started out just holding a microphone and doing rap songs, but then the club she frequented became a venue for her record spinning skills when Du Bois introduced her to the record playing decks. How did that happen?
I don't know whether I was lucky or I don't know whether they were just, you know, interested to see, you know, this girl DJ who just came up. But somehow the DJs I worked with initially were very helpful.
She did have to contend with having to play at unpopular hours and dealing with some harassment as she built her career, but she prevailed. Meanwhile, across the continent in Guinea, a little girl grew up in a town called Sigiri. And for anyone who knows something about West African music, this is the birthplace of Guinea's finest traditional singers, or griots. But Nakani Kanté wasn't one of them.
Salut tout le monde, je m'appelle Nakani Kanté, je viens de la Guinée-Conakry.
She was not born into a musical griot family, and that meant that she had no right to sing and play music.
That's Brian Postman's reporting. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, along with our engineer Jimmy Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very, very good day.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA newsfeed. VOAnews.com. Looking for something? Headline news, interviews, analysis? We've got it all on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.